From Colombo, Malaysia, this is Season Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this current edition of the Season Podcast. My name is Aziz Durrani, and I'm here today with Finlay McPherson. Hi, Finlay.
Hello, Aziz.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. We're sitting in downtown Colombo in Sri Lanka.
That's right, yeah. We're here for the Problem Bank Intervention and Resolution course in Colombo. And actually, it's been very successful so far. In fact, the Central Bank of Sri Lanka have been very hospitable. We got to see a bit of Sri Lanka. We went to Kandy a few days back. And it's a really beautiful country.
It's well worth a visit. I think it's a country that's underestimated in many respects. And now that travel times are becoming shorter, it's certainly a place that I would put on my go-to list if I wanted a nice holiday, which combines both beaches and also scenic inland tours of tea farms and plantations.
Right, correct. And yeah, I think I wouldn't let the recent bombings put people off, because we've had no trouble at all and it's been very, very pleasant.
Absolutely not.
People are very friendly.
Absolutely not. I think that was just a one-off, which was unfortunate, because the people, by and large, and this is my second time in Sri Lanka, are very, very friendly, very hospitable, and nothing is too much trouble.
Good. Okay. So we've been hearing from various speakers on the Problem Bank course, and from FDIC and the Korean and Bundesbank and so on. We're, of course, going to be running a case study and going through the actual application of some of the main issues in a failing or a troubled bank, which will be over the next, tomorrow. And then you'll have some additional sessions after that. But Finlay, why don't you, for the benefit of our listeners, you've had a very illustrious career in both the banking side of things as well as the regulatory side. So why don't you give us a quick kind of 5-minute debrief of your career to date?
Okay, I will do that, Aziz, thank you. Well, I'm a career banker. I've been in banking for over 40 years, and I've been very, very fortunate to work with the likes of Standard Chartered Bank, HSBC, and Royal Bank of Scotland, where I started my banking career, where I learned the basics to a very high degree. But I've always had the wanderlust to move out of Scotland, like many Scottish people, unfortunately. But I think Scots people tend to travel very well. And as a consequence of that, I say I've been very fortunate to have lived and worked in South Africa, Singapore, Thailand, and latterly I've just come back from Hong Kong, where I was regional head of commercial real estate and hotels for HSBC for the whole of Asia Pacific. But prior to me coming to Hong Kong, I actually had 6 years at the Prudential Regulation Authority, which was the son of the Financial Services Authority, and I joined them back in 2009.
Right, that's of course where we met.
Yes.
I also joined in 2009, just after the financial crisis. And that was a very exciting time, right? Because it was right on the aftermath of the crisis, and there was a lot of pressure to figure out, you know, how much worse could things be, where are the hidden losses still sitting, and so on. And you were involved in quite a lot of that stress testing work and so on, weren't you?
Well, I was probably at the forefront of it because, to be honest, I joined in 2009. At the beginning of 2009, I was brought into the FSA as their property specialist, as real estate specialist. But because of my extensive background in risk and corporate banking, I spent probably the first part of my 18 months there focusing on the broader corporate issues that banks were facing. And I have to say, it's probably one of the most exciting and enjoyable times that I've experienced in my whole banking career. It was quite different. In many ways, we were pioneering, because nobody had ever experienced the likes of what we were going through at that point in time. It had never happened before in financial services history. So there was a lot of pioneering, but there was a lot of searching to work out how to approach certain things in the right way. But it was a fascinating time, and to go through it from investigating banks to work out what the problems were and how they'd occurred, to helping or working with the banks in terms of what they were going to have to do next to resolve their problems. To come through all of that and see the finished article and how banks came through that time stronger and much more structured, I found quite self-fulfilling, and I really enjoyed that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can definitely echo that sentiment. And, you know, one of the things that I remember quite clearly is, for example, stress testing. Now we've got a whole framework. It's a process. There's a system. Banks have the ready-made templates. But at that time, there was no such industry. We had to kind of come up with it very quickly, go into the banks, assess their portfolios and try and stress it and work through that and work out what the losses could be.
At the beginning, it boiled down to experience and expert judgment. And I was fortunate to work with two other gentlemen who, between the three of us, we had about 140 years of risk experience and banking experience.
Wow.
And we were able to sit down and analyse the various banks, their portfolios, and come to a general conclusion as to how risky we thought those various portfolios were, because clearly some asset classes are more riskier than others. And we used a very, very simplistic method at that time in terms of working out what the expected loss might be. And I have to say that, you know, by and large, over the large number of banks that we assessed on that basis, we weren't actually too far wrong in terms of what the outputs were. As Aziz has said, we moved on from that and we became more and more sophisticated in terms of how to model the various portfolios using more analytical tools. But you can't escape the fact that to make that analytical tool work, you have to add in a degree of expert judgment. And I think that's what makes the difference in many respects in being able to call a situation as to whether it's high risk, low risk, or no risk.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting is now if you look at the Bank of England's current concurrent stress test and the FDFS framework, the firm data submission form, you know, all the underlying asset classes and the treatment of the assets and the splitting up of the different risk categories is actually what we had come up with and what we were using back in the day. So that's kind of still survived, albeit it's now got a stronger governance structure around it.
Yes, it's a deeper structure, and there's obviously a lot more governance around it. But at the end of the day, I do strongly believe that there is no substitute for experience and expert judgment, and you potentially talk yourself into a trap by going down the formulated route, because working to a formula doesn't always give you the right answer, because no formula can fit every situation. So you have to make some judgment calls on what is appropriate and what isn't at that point in time.
Yep, and I think also, you know, that's a really good point, because if you now look at IFRS 9 and the kind of the implications of that, there's a big tendency for banks to implement this whole model structure. And then when you ask them, okay, what are your provisions? They'll say X, and we'll say Y, and they'll say because it's just come out of this black box, right? But we still need that credit risk judgment and expertise to say, well, in this scenario, how would it affect this customer in particular, and really understand how it works.
Exactly, because if you take the the formula at face value, and if you take the data at face value, then you may, as I said earlier, come up with the wrong answer. As an example, if you get a bank's loan book, which is broken down by risk grade, then you can see what the risk profile of the business is. Now, by applying a formula to that, it will give you a certain answer. Where the expert judgment comes in is to whether or not that risk profile is intuitive or not, because I can think of several examples of banks where we reviewed their business and we discovered that the risk models were not accurately predicting on a consistent basis the risk profile of the bank. Now, that causes two problems. It means, one, that the risk profile of the bank is not what it appears to be. It is actually potentially higher risk. And secondly, because the bank is using those models to calculate their risk-weighted assets and therefore their capital requirements, they could end up being severely undercapitalised without anybody realising it. So it's important to combine both the technical piece of using the analytical models that are available to you, but at the same time you have to step back from that and think about the point that is it intuitive? Does it make sense? And I think that's where the added benefit of expert judgment comes into play.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And actually, I want to come back to that a bit later on. But first, I thought it might be useful just to talk a little bit more about the commercial real estate market in this region, and in particular in CSUN member countries. CRE is often one of those key areas which banks generally focus on, and it's also led to a number of crises within banks when they haven't done it properly. So I thought it would be useful if you can just kind of share your views on where do you see the market now? You know, there's obviously a lot of construction I'm seeing here in Colombo, in Sri Lanka, but also across various countries in this whole region. How do you see it, the current state of the market?
Well, I think the way to look at it is, at the moment, the current state of the market is probably stable because every country's economies are still growing and moving forwards, and there continues to be demand for real estate construction, either on the residential side or on the commercial side. Where the dangers lie is that if there was a sudden, unexpected shock, there could be an overreaction to in the market to real estate. Because if we look at the financial crisis in Europe back in 2009 and onwards, obviously banks had a lot of real estate in their loan books. Now, there's a reason for that, because banks at times find it very, very difficult to generate core business from a number of different asset classes, whether it's trading businesses or anything else. But it's very, very easy to generate real estate business because someone comes to you and they say they want some money to build something, and you can actually shorten the lead-in period to creating a facility very, very quickly. But there are two sides to real estate. If you do it properly, you should not lose any money, or at least not a lot of money, because it's an asset class where you not only get security over the property, but you also get security over the cash flow. So you've got complete sighting of both the cash flow and the asset quality. Whereas in a trading business, if you lend to a trading business, it's probably on an unsecured basis, and you don't know what's going wrong until it's gone wrong. On the other side of the coin, if you do not do real estate properly and you do not analyse the transaction properly, you can get yourself into difficulty. And regrettably, that's where many of the banks fell foul of real estate lending in the financial crisis in the UK. In Asia, I still believe that the market has got opportunities, but the key point for me is, how do we help and increase the technical knowledge of the bankers so that they understand real estate properly, the dynamics of real estate, how to structure it, and how to manage it once it's in course of construction or when it's being built, and also to understand the market dynamics? Because if we look at residential, for example, in China, as the market and China's economy grows at a fairly rapid rate on a consistent basis because the demand is there, it's quite easy for banks to lend against a residential development of 1,000 apartments or houses, because the demand is so great that they will sell out before even the first brick has been put on top of another brick. But you can't always say that because that's the way it works in China, for example, that you can go down to Australia and believe that you could build the same number of units and be equally successful. So you have to understand the local market dynamics, the local area where these properties are going to be built, because there's a a common statement that when we talk about property, that property is all about location, location, location. Mm-hmm. And that is so very true. And it's important to understand the location dynamics and also the demand dynamics, whether it's a shopping centre or a hotel even, because hotels are very susceptible to the wrong location, no matter which brand is above the door. So it's important to get the analysis right to make sure that you don't fall foul of things that could happen.
Right. Yeah, certainly we need to make sure that that's all happening accurately. But with a lot of these developments, often they're kind of sold off plan to the Chinese buyers, even if you're in Sri Lanka or Malaysia or Thailand. So that demand is actually spreading across the region. And I just wondered, obviously, we should also mention the current trade war and the implications of that, because just, you know, today we've been seeing the stock market is, or the US stock market has fallen 3% as it's all escalating. So do you think that's going to change things, or could it actually increase it as people want to, in China, want to move their money out even faster and invest elsewhere?
Well, it might. And I'm not an economist, so I can't comment on that. But what I would say is that the strategic direction of Asian investors and the property developers is often quite different compared to those in Europe. In Europe, it tends to be a much shorter time frame, mm-hmm. so that people build something and they want to sell it and then get out of it. Yes. And they want to do it in a relatively short time frame. And they're not necessarily thinking about the long-term future of the location and the economy. I'm not saying that they don't, because the good ones do, but the difference is that in Asia, for example, in some countries, I know that the developers will take a long-term view on what they're doing. So therefore, they don't necessarily panic because there's been some economic blips along the way. Right. And I think a good example of that, perhaps, Aziz, is if you look at Johor Bahru, mm-hmm. which is just across the causeway from Singapore. Now, I can remember Johor Bahru when I was in Singapore about 30 years ago, being just a very, very small town, yeah. with very little development whatsoever. And I was amazed and surprised at just how it has changed so much. Mm-hmm. But the staggering thing is that the high level of residential development that has taken place already, yeah. and which is programmed to take place over the next 5 years. But the people behind those developments have taken a very, very long-term view,
right.
on that location. Uh-huh. Because otherwise, one wouldn't go invest. And build that amount, yeah. of residential,
yeah.
without believing that that will come to fruition over a period of time, and they will, you know, buyers will come and people will live in those enlarged townships.
Yeah. And I guess there's some political issues between Malaysia and China, but even then you can see Singapore is completely outgrowing its space, and there's a need to house, you know, all the workers there and have access to cheaper housing and so on. So inevitably, I think you're right, in the longer term, that land and those buildings will get occupied.
No, exactly, because Singapore, having lived there again, is a wonderful place to live, but in recent years they've built it up a bit more, to the point where personally I think it's slightly overbuilt now. I'm not convinced that the way it is now is as good as it was, you know, a few years ago, because the population has sort of gone from 2.5 million to roughly 5.5 million. And they talk about increasing that slightly more. But I don't know where you can put people, yep. in Singapore unless you keep
building out
yeah. into the sea. But the key benefit with Singapore is that they've got Malaysia literally across the bridge. And accommodation is much cheaper there. Housing is much cheaper. All the facilities are there. If you're a Singaporean and you've got a yacht, for example, and you can't get mooring in Singapore, mm-hmm. you can buy a nice house on the Straits with your own harbour, literally.
Okay.
So there's a lot of benefit from, yeah. looking at Johor Bahru and Singapore almost as one entity.
Right.
But they may need to build another bridge so that they can handle yeah. the traffic that's going backwards,
sure,
and forwards.
Because I know that you can spend hours waiting there on some
days,
right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Finlay, that's really interesting. I thought what would be good as well is Given that you've got quite a unique profile in having had this long career in banking, and then you spent a good period, 6 years or so, at the PRA and the Bank of England, and then you went back out into HSBC and the banking market. I thought it'd be useful to get some advice from you for supervisors in the CSUN member country central banks around, you know, what are the kind of things that they should focus on. And you already mentioned earlier on getting into some more of the detail around judgments rather than just trusting the models. I think if I can suggest one to start off with, one area where a lot of the countries are moving is into risk-based supervision. So they want to move away from a pure CAMELS-based approach and more risk-based. The problem with that is, to do risk-based supervision, you need people who understand risk and have that deep expertise in risk. And often what we see is most of the supervisors join as kind of graduates and spend their whole careers. And so they haven't had that external experience in a bank to understand really where the issues are. So maybe starting with that, what sort of advice would you give to a central bank in building up and implementing risk-based supervision?
Well, I think there's two elements to that. One, you could bring in some senior or retired senior bankers from the market who have got the experience in the background to assist the supervisors understand their institutions much better. Another and obviously lower cost option, which actually we did to an extent in the PRA in London, was to second some of our younger up-and-coming supervisors to certain banks for 6 months or thereabouts. So it was normal for supervisors on the graduate programme at the end of their three-year period, they would get seconded to an HSBC or a Barclays or a Royal Bank of Scotland for 6 months. And invariably, they came back with a completely different picture in their heads in terms of what banking was all about. Because fundamentally, as a supervisor, the starting point is, do you understand the entity in which you're supervising? And you need to be able to look at it and be able to evaluate what the business model is all about and whether that makes sense or not. And only by doing that can you follow a risk-based supervisory process, because unless you're able to sort of identify how a particular institution fits into that risk profile, you don't really know perhaps the level of risk you should be attaching to that institution.
Okay.
The second point that I think I would make to you is, when you are dealing with financial institutions, you're meeting management at all levels, from people in departments who do the daily chores right up to the chief executive. Now, when you're dealing with people, you can get a different perspective of what they do and how they do it. And one of the points that I would encourage supervisors to think about is that when you go to visit an institution, not only are you there to take a note of what they're doing and how they're doing it, but my suggestion to you would be to look across the table at whoever you're talking to and ask yourself the question, are they really capable of doing this job? Are they really portraying the bank in a manner which is actually open and honest and transparent, in that they're not trying to just answer your question because they know that you want a certain answer? You have to question and challenge the executive at all levels to fully understand how they run that business, because one of the points that we discovered, and it seems obvious but to me now, but one of the points that came out in a number of the bank reviews that we did was that although banks have boards of executive directors and also non-executive directors, very often the only challenge that the executive ever get is from the regulator, and that is, it's quite a telling statement actually, which means that you are probably the one who can actually challenge the institution in terms of what they're doing and how they're doing it. Yeah. And as a sense check to that, you should then be asking the non-executive directors, what challenge do they provide? Do they really understand the bank's business? Because at the end of the day, we're playing for very high stakes when we talk about financial stability in any country. So it's important that you feel comfortable with the people who run your institutions, that they actually know what they're doing and they're doing their best to follow and implement the correct regulatory procedures.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And in fact, it's a big challenge, I think, for supervisors, because often you have, you know, you might have, a supervisor might have been in the role for a few years or 5 years or 10 years. They're facing off against a CEO or a management team who've got kind of 20, 30 plus years. And there's that natural fear that how can I challenge someone with that authority? So, and I've often found one answer to that is actually getting in and doing those file reviews and really kicking the tires, because then you have some real evidence to say, well, you said you're doing everything correct, but looking at this credit file, you haven't followed this procedure or whatever, and it gives you something solid to lean on.
Yes, I mean, just to sort of run through the process very quickly, generally on a risk review, we would talk to the senior people first of all, and they would assure us that they have the policies and the procedures and the risk management structure that evidences that they are following everything correctly and that they don't run a high-risk business. Now, the way to counter that is by doing a file review, as Aziz has said, because you very quickly identify whether the bankers are following the correct policy and procedures. And once you've done that review and you've found perhaps some discrepancies, when you go back and speak to the senior management, you suddenly have four aces in your hand, because at that level, it's probably not reasonable or expected to assume that the chief executive or somebody at that senior level would know the detail on every specific file. But what he's done, or his chief risk officer has done, has said to you that they do everything properly, but you've now got evidence that they haven't done it properly. So suddenly the pendulum swings in your favour, and you'll get a lot more cooperation out of them once you've proved that actually you know more, or you know enough about their bank to be able to show that they have certain things that they have to resolve.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. And I think given that we're here on this course, we should also talk about recovery and resolution planning. And obviously that's another kind of big area that developed after the financial crisis. But my big worry about that is we've now got it very well documented, and there's a whole series of procedures and documents that we need from the banks. But when it comes to the crunch, often in practice, it doesn't roll out as you think it will, of course. And you know, politically, it becomes very difficult. And we've seen this in Europe with the Bank Resolution and Recovery Directive, a very strong piece of legislation. But in Italy, when a couple of the banks collapsed, that was kind of ignored because of political considerations. So what's your kind of thoughts around that side of things?
Well, I think it comes back down to, firstly, knowing your bank. Once you know and understand the bank, you'll be able to determine how you view them from a risk perspective, and how you could potentially sit down and rank order a lot of the credit institutions in terms of who's good at what they do and who's not so good at what they do. And then I think you have to move to the next phase, which is we call in the UK close and continuous supervision. Because generally speaking, once the banks know that you know how they operate and where the pressure points could or could not be in that institution, the fact that you have a consistent dialogue with them at all levels, I would suggest, to make sure that they are actually following their business model, that there's been no business model creep, in that they're not overly exposed or concentrated in one particular area, and that the management processes and procedures actually are being adhered to. Because generally speaking, when a bank gets into difficulty, as we experienced, it's not just one problem that the bank has got, it can be many problems. And that can range from having no management information, so they can't actually get sight of what it is they've got and how they're managing it, down to the chief executive may be very strong-willed and the chairman can't control them, and everybody basically just does as they're told, which of course can lead to the bank going in the wrong direction. And when it when something happens, it's too late. So I think being able to stay close to your institution, not, I don't mean you have to be there every day, but on a regular 3-monthly basis, having conversations with the chief executive, the chief risk officer, and asking for certain key risk management information, you can track that institution and can potentially spot where potential hotspots could arise. And the way to deal with that is to then do an ad hoc review of certain business areas or certain processes, just to get comfort that things are working properly, or if in fact they've chosen not to do what they said they would do or they're supposed to do. So it's about supervision, really, in terms of knowing and understanding who and what you're dealing with.
Yeah. Thank you, Finlay. I think we've covered quite a few broad areas and good tips for supervisors in this region. We're coming just to the end of the podcast. Is there any other final thoughts that you want to share before we leave?
I would just say, look, everyone that works in regulation is making an enormous contribution in their own way to the safety and the financial stability of the banking system in your own countries, and you should be proud of the work that you do. But I would say to you, you can never stop learning. So always think about how can I learn more and understand about banking and what the potential issues could or could not be. This is becoming more challenging as we move more into electronic banking and third-party providers, etc. But I would come back to the point where if you're listening and you would like to know more about banking, why don't you ask your manager, your supervisor, can I go to one of the banks for 6 months just to understand a bit more about how banks really work? Because I think you'll come back refreshed and your knowledge in terms of what happens on a day-to-day basis in a bank will be well worth the effort.
Great, Finlay. I think that's some excellent advice that many people would benefit from following. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. And also thank you for coming out here to Sri Lanka and supporting CSIM and on this course and sharing all the knowledge you have and hopefully educating the participants we have here.
It's been a pleasure, Aziz. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, thank you very much.